Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. This is the final program in this series, 100 Years of Women on Campus. The series was one of a number of events created to mark this significant anniversary. Amongst these were the Or Concours exhibition at the Valletta campus, the HUMS seminar dedicated to women on campus, as well as other University of Malta initiatives to get the female agenda into the foreground where most needed. My two guests today are not actually with me in the studio, but I was privileged to be able to recently record conversations in their homes. They are both medical graduates from the class of 1952, Dr. Aurora Aquilina, who graduated as Aurora Abela, and Professor John Rizzonaudi. Both are in their 90s, and both have an enviable capacity for recall, and they talk to me about their years at university and beyond. Professor Rizzonaudi needs little introduction. His medical career started in Malaysia and continued in Malta after his return to the island in 1961. In 1987, he was appointed Parliamentary Secretary for the Care of the Elderly. In 1992, Parliamentary Secretary for Health. Professor Rizzonaudi worked tirelessly for the development of nursing within higher education and later became Chancellor of the University of Malta, which has recently bestowed upon him a degree honoris causa. Dr. Aurora Aquilina has had perhaps a less prominent career. However, Dr. Aurora, as well as her sister Adriana and another female graduate on the course of 1952, Mary Camilleri, can claim the accolade of 7th female Maltese medical doctors. For reasons which will become clear during the programme, Dr. Aquilina did not work for long as a medical doctor, but did practice at various periods in her life as a pharmacist, having gained her PhD while studying medicine. We shall be listening to their thoughts on their university days through extracts from the conversations I had with them in the last months. The recordings took place outside the studio, so apologies in advance for any offstage sounds you might hear. I have looked into the lives of several of those early graduates and found that there were diverse reasons for their choosing to follow a university course. One or two graduates, such as Maria Cristina Tufinio, and back in 1931, and Carmen Attard, much more recently in 1960, have left us a written record of their aspirations, a primary source, so to speak, whereas others have been witnessed through children or grandchildren of the graduates, such as the DiMaio sisters. Others, such as the family female role models that Teresa Camilleri most definitely had in her life, one can only really surmise. These were stories of determination and courage. However, as we shall see from Dr. Aurora Aquilina, parental influence in favour of a university education was not always totally understood and appreciated.
What about your family? So why did you think of going to university?
I don't know, because it was the war. No, my father said, no, you finished your school, your GCSE is over, you have to do something. Without asking us, something like that. You study medicine. Why should I study medicine if I don't want to? I had to.
He obviously saw in you something.
And my sister, both of us. My sister, she worked a lot because she was married and she went to Africa at colonial service. But as a maid here, and in those days, it was not difficult, impossible for a lady doctor to work. It was impossible. Nobody wanted to be men. So I said, why did my father put me at university if he knew that it was so difficult to get a job? No, a woman at the age of doctor, no. So you see, we got married, and there was another thing. When you get married, if you're working at a hospital, you lose your job.
Yes, of course. Married women weren't allowed
to
work.
So when I got married, I had to leave my job at the university, at the hospital. I had to leave it.
You could only have done private practice.
It's stupid. Because what happened then, we left small town. I was married, and we went to England for 2 years. Well, that's all. But when I came back then, things were very completely changed. It was only my husband who worked.
Mm-hmm.
I was a chemist. We graduated even in chemistry in pharmacy.
Yes, you had PhD.
Yes, pharmacy. Yeah. I used to work in pharmacy because I couldn't take a job with the government.
And it went on for many years.
It was nasty. Mm-hmm. Today they can't do it because there are so many women.
No, definitely not.
I left my work as a doctor because things changed.
This is an example of the fact that parents still exerted an enormous amount of pressure on their children, unusually in this case, given that it was still the 1940s, pro and not contra a professional career. Her words also indicate the prejudice that there still was amongst Maltese about using the professional services of a female doctor. The experience of Professor Rizzonaudi was somewhat different, in that he was keen to become a doctor from a very young age, and his mother supporting him all the way.
Did you always want to become a medic?
Yes.
From when you were small?
We were five children. My mother was Naudi, and my father was Rizzo. And I became Rizzonaudi, actually the registrar. When I graduated, told me, there's someone else, Rizzo. What's the surname of your mother? And I said, Naudi. And then he said, you are John Rizzo Naudi. And then when I traveled, I was a Dr. Naudi, J.R. Naudi. Anyway.
So when did your parents want you to be a doctor?
Yes,
or?
Yes.
They were keen.
My mother has a long history of doctors. Now Dr. Naudi family. Dr. Naudi, now back to the orders of the night.
Yeah? Really?
And in particular, when the British came, they were doctors, and they were very, very near the governor, and they used to give him a lot of advice.
So it was a tradition. So
tradition.
You didn't go against the family, business or something.
My mother, at the age of 10, 12, 11 years, told me, you are going to become a doctor. We have a lot of doctors in our history, and I think you should make it. And then I started to study, and so this is World War, 1942. I was 15 years old then. We had the first bombs on Malta were on us. We were liberating Sida, and they threw their bombs in Marsamshet and the Grand Harbor, but mostly Marsamshet, the bombs were. One fell behind our house. We were all very frightened. We didn't have a shelter.
No? It was the early days,
and
I suppose.
We never had a shelter because they're full of quarries. And I can remember, we had a very strong table, and we put it 49 Mcda seafront. It was a very good house, actually. It was an arch, and we had this table, and during a raid we went underneath it. And I remember praying, oh, Rabrano.
Very hesitantly.
Then we got used to it. Then after 3 weeks, we went to Rabat.
So those were still school days?
Yeah, school days.
The war didn't interrupt your studies?
No.
The war years do not seem to have interrupted the studies of either Dr. Aquilina or Professor Rizzonaudi, except that they both had to wait for the 1945 course to open, as University of Malta courses opened only every 3 years. But it gave Aurora's younger sister Adriana time to catch up, so they ended up following the course together. Dr. Aquilina's first impression of the University of Malta sounds a little traumatic.
Do you recall your going to university, literally going to the Valletta campus, going to into the university for the first time and finding yourself in this environment?
It was terrible.
In what way?
Because it was just after the war. And you see, at home my mother was very severe. We couldn't speak or talk to anybody. So when you get to the university and find yourself, you know, in a big hall, all boys, you can imagine.
A bit of a shock.
Ooh. My sister was stronger than I was, much stronger. Mm. And she insisted. In fact, they called her Spitfire.
Lovely.
They used to call my sister Spitfire because she was straight. But it's not, I wasn't that type. I was timid, very timid. And I found myself all surrounded by... I didn't know where I was. I didn't know in the first 2 years. Because those days we used to have the first 2 years, the sixth form. Mm-hmm. It was done at the university.
Sure.
So, well, we had nice professors, nice friends.
The name that looms large with regard to those first two preparatory years is Owen Fogarty, remembered well by both Professor Rizzonaudi and Dr. Aquilina, and both recalled the student pranks often initiated by George Isler, later to become a much appreciated doctor and a respected politician. In fact, when I contacted his son, the present Dr. George Isler, to ask permission to mention his father by name in this program, I recounted some of the pranks mentioned, and his reaction was that he thought there were probably worse ones that the interviewees had politely left out. In the following extracts, we shall hear about Owen Fogarty's idiosyncrasies, some student pranks, and about the effect of women on the course.
But I don't think you remember Mr. Fogarty.
Owen Fogarty, yes, only by reputation.
We had Mr. Fogarty with us. He loved us. He loved us a lot. He helped all the students with sport. But we as students, not me, of course, we as students, we were very cruel with him.
Huh?
Yes, we were very cruel. We had, I don't know why, he loved us a lot, but we were very cruel with him. We used to tease him. In those days, of course, there was a companion of mine, Dr. Hisler. He was a real champion in this. You can't imagine what they used to do during lectures. They used to buy those moon tigers, you remember, they put it under his chair, whilst he was lecturing, putting it under his chair. And of course, this man, he used to be very angry. Very, very angry. He used to hate Madame Butterfly. No, that's not an opera, it's an operette. So to tease him, all the students used to come to the choir of Madame Butterfly. He got angry with this. Very angry. And not once or twice, more than once or twice, he shouted, all the male element out. All the male element out. So what the thing is, we only remained just a few of us in the hall, all of us. But in those days, we had English, so the law students, the medics, they were all in the same room. So you can imagine, all the male element count.
And there can't be many women left in the room.
Nobody. An empty hall. I don't know why, because he loved the students.
But I think the students were a bit naughtier then than they are today.
At the time, the university was in Valletta.
Yes, of course.
And we had a club in front of us, and we used to play in entertainment.
Uh-huh.
And once we had a lunch, I remember, We had to have a lunch, all the students, Arjean or something, someone. The thing is, the three men we sat down for lunch, all the students took their part of their lunch and they started to put it in the wall. And on the wall, everybody threw it at the wall. We came to court. We went to court.
Really?
Of course. And I mean, us women, we didn't know anything about it, but we had to go to St. John's the same. The university people put us at school, to court. It's the only time in my life that I went to court.
That's lovely.
But we were not given any penalty, but I mean, we had to go.
And the funny thing again is Professor Fogarty, because on the first day, we had all the students there in the big one, about 120 they were loitering there. And he was telling us about the people who suffered because of the Germans were treating them badly, killing them, and this sort of thing. And then this person, at the end of it all, "Professor, were you there?" And he said, "You walking lump of self-importance."
Very expressive.
And we all laughed.
Professor Fogarty, his lecture used to start at 12. But he never came at 12. We used to wait up to 12:45 for him to come to teach, to learn whatever English. So we got bored, waiting for nothing. And also, in Valletta, there was in the stairs, there was a boy at the door through which we could see the Jesuit church, like yes. A balcony.
Yes, I know it well.
And we used to go there for mass, so that we don't lose time. There was a mass at 12, and we used to go there for mass. Up there in that little, it was like a balcony.
Yes, next time I go to the church, I'll imagine you up there watching, yes.
There. We used to get angry at times. We used to leave anything alone. But I mean, one wait for 3/4 hour for a lecture.
Quite so.
Nothing.
It's longer than the academic 10 minutes that you're supposed to wait.
He was good, very good to us. He was very nice. Everybody loved him.
Yes.
Although we were naughty.
But he was quite feared, Fogarty.
Everybody loved him. Mm. I remember at his funeral, the whole of the university was with him. I remember that.
It was quite rare for women to come here.
Yes. Were they always the goodies in the front row?
About 5 or 6 they were.
Did it make any difference to you the men, I mean, in the course? Did it make you behave any better? It doesn't sound like it.
No, but... I mean, I was in the front row behind them, actually, second row.
You wanted to listen to what was being said.
And I always sort of passed my comments, which they could hear.
The first 2 preparatory years seem to have passed in quite a carefree fashion. Some studying, of course, but fun as well. But when the medical course proper began, things had to change. In these following excerpts, both Dr. Aquilina and Professor Rizzonardi give us a taste of what those years were like.
When you started the actual course itself,
I suppose it all became a little bit more serious somehow. Things changed. The first 2 years were light. I mean, much lighter. We could do a lot of things. We used to have plays, recitals. I used to play the piano. So we used to have concerts, everything, plays, we could hold a whole play. But then after that, things had to change for the study. But even so, we had lectures at Valletta, some of them. Lectures at the hospital. So up and down and up. Yes. It was terrible because all the professors used to teach us at university. They wanted us up at the hospital. Mm. So one lecture there, the other lecture there. It was the time when Princess Elizabeth was here.
Oh, I see.
And she used to live in one of those villas there, up the hill from
Quite a mancha, yes.
Which was our joke now. Buy some toys a day.
Keep you fit.
I used to meet her.
Really?
We used to meet her because our times, the hours of our lecture, they were the same as hers. She used to get out from her house. This is very normal, simply this, because her husband was in the Navy.
Yes.
The boat was here, he was here. Mm. And then she came here to Malta. Mm. She used to go to see her husband play polo.
At the Marsa Club?
Obviously. And so we used to see her. Oh, I remember. She used to put a handkerchief in her head.
How nice. It was a lovely memory.
Nearly every day we used to meet her.
Gosh.
But I mean, suffering from one letter to the 10 o'clock in November, it was too much for us.
A real hassle.
One professor wanted this, the other professor wanted that. Mm. So we had the running up.
The running around, yes. They wouldn't be inconvenienced.
No, of course not.
Do you remember in particular any of the professors, the tutors that you had?
I remember there was Peter Paul de Bono.
Gosh.
And his brother Josie, Craig, Rosal Biffa, he used to teach us anatomy. He was very, very, very great. We had very good professors.
What about the professors that you worked with when you started the medical course? Which are the professors that you remember?
Kassar Zamit.
Did he have a speciality?
Maltese mostly it was.
So this was still in the early days, before the course actually started, the medical course?
It would have been the preparatory.
Preparatory. But the professors who taught you on the medical course, were there particular professors that stand out in your mind?
Oh, there were, no. Walter Garado, Joseph Zamet Memper was my cousin. Joseph Zamet Memper was always difficult, eh? But I managed. He would want me to carry his bag. every time I would do it.
What were the facilities like after the war?
No, we had the chemistry there. That's another story. The laboratory, the one who was in charge, I always forgot his name. But he used to say that we did not take chemicals, because we all took chemicals.
What did you do with them?
To put explosives. On my roof in Sida, there was a small room. And I had that one as where I studied. And I never told my mother that I had explosives, that I had.
I bet you didn't.
And some of them were sugar, something like that, glucose. And at the end of it, there was something, and then boom. What are you doing upstairs? No, Mama, I'm experiments.
Fun ones, by the sounds of it.
At the time, I was still studying music. If that's fair, I was good at music. I'm sorry, not sorry, but I boast of it, because I was good at music. And I used to play and continue playing until my Lara said. In fact, I got a scholarship for that.
Gosh.
Yes. Which my mother, of course, didn't permit, because it was the time of the war yet, at university anyway. But, I mean, it's like the music, because you need to study music, but only university. And I remember during some lectures, one of the professors used to tell me, "Oh, Miss Amelia, why did you leave your music? Why did you leave your music?" I remember, I thought, how can I play? How can I do both? So I had to leave music. I used to blame myself, but, I mean, after that.
I was very lucky with my mother and father. And then it became my big, any problems with the families, of patients and things like that, I would go there and sort it out. Because I had the best parents, and I knew what it was.
So you would say that the years that you spent at the university doing your course, they were tough because obviously you had these exams and lectures and a lot to learn, but you enjoyed it.
Yes, you were happy.
It really was a privilege for me to chat with and listen to both my guests today. I'm only sorry that because of time constraints, I could not add more of their voice on the programme. At this juncture, I would like to thank the Pro-Rector, Professor Carmen Samut, for her support in this initiative, and all the many participants in this series. I would also like to thank the administrative staff at Campus FM, who are always so accommodating, and the sound engineers for their patience. A particular thank you to Dr. Oscar Aquilina for introducing me to his mother, Dr. Aurora Aquilina, and to Miss Maria Tonna, daughter of Professor Rizzonaudi, who facilitated my meeting with her father, and of course, Professor John Rizzonaudi himself, for inviting me into his home to talk about his university experiences. I hope you've enjoyed this series, and thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.